Hello, and welcome to the Musician's Mentor podcast. My name is Travis Mark, and today I have the very, very distinct pleasure of talking to my buddy Todd Pipes. Todd is the bass player and vocalist for the band Deep Blue Something. He is also the owner of Phantom Power Studios in Texas. He's a wonderful mastering engineer and songwriter and musician and producer and person. No, but seriously, Todd's just a cool dude. He also happened to write one of the biggest songs from the 90s that you've probably ever heard, which we talk about a little bit in this interview. If you're enjoying these episodes, please do me a favor and give us a rating or a review on your preferred streaming network. And, even go as far as sharing this with your musician friends who you think may get something out of it. All right, that's enough of my blabbering. Let's get on with it. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Todd Pipes. Hey, Todd, how's it going, man?
Oh, it's going all right. How are you?
Good, good, good. Okay, well, I know we spoke for a couple minutes prior, but let's just jump straight into it. Would you mind giving our listeners a brief introduction as to who Todd Pipes is, please?
All right. So I am Todd Pipes, probably best known as the bass player and lead vocalist, or one of the lead vocalists for Deep Blue Something. I actually had been a producer and session musician for a very long time after that, or at least when the band slowed down. And then over the years, I have shifted more into mastering while I kind of do other things in my life too. And then over the past few years, the band has started doing some fun things again. So that's kind of who I am and where I've been, and I guess sort of at least what direction I'm going.
Awesome. I want to talk to you a little bit about that, and we're going to jump around a little here and there. I've got a bunch of stuff prepared, but you know, where the conversation goes, we'll kind of go. Let's just talk about that for a second. So, I mean, I saw some interviews and I listened to a couple interviews online to do some research for this interview. And there was something in an interview you did where you were talking about the beginning stages of Deep Blue Something and how, like, you guys really had no idea about being in a band or how to be in a band. And obviously you did very well. I mean, Breakfast at Tiffany's is a worldwide hit, and you've had others as well, but obviously that is a monster hit around the world, or was. Yeah. So just talk us through some of the sort of lessons, especially the hard lessons that you felt you guys had to learn along the way of trying to navigate being in a band.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting, because looking back, I'd say for the most part, we made some fairly decent decisions. Some of it being out of ignorance, maybe. Because even, you know, kind of mentioning, we knew how to be in a band because all of us had kind of been in different bands. But what we didn't know is how to be professional. Like, I remember when I had transferred up to the University of North Texas, or Toby had transferred up there. I had joined him up there. I was working on my master's degree, and that's when we had decided we would start a new band. And we were both amazed at how professional everyone seemed, and we didn't know anything about how to do any of that kind of stuff. Like, we didn't know where to get a promo picture. We didn't know how on earth you could get enough money to go to a studio and make a demo. I mean, you know, and I tell people this all the time, we had to buy, if we broke a guitar string, we would go and buy that one guitar string, because we couldn't let our parents know that we were doing this. We couldn't ask for any help, much, you know, to buy guitar strings, much less can we have money to go make demos and stuff. And all these bands in Dallas and Denton, they all had this, and mailing lists, t-shirts, all this stuff that really seemed super professional. So the only thing we knew to do in a kind of coming from our sports backgrounds, because we're all, funnily enough, most of us are soccer players.
Cool.
We only knew that, well, the only way to win is to practice harder than anyone else. And so that was the only thing we had control of. So we would rehearse obsessively, like hours and hours and hours. I think everybody thinks that we exaggerate how much we used to rehearse, or that we still rehearse, actually. But we were so over rehearsed that when we played, it was just like a freight train. Like, even people that didn't like us would be like, I gotta admit, they're amazing at what they do, because that's all we knew. So we were selling out places before we had any of the stuff that these other bands had.
Wow.
Because that's all we knew to do, you know. Because people kept saying, you know, hey, I want to get your band to play in our club. And like, oh, okay, great. Well, can you get us a demo? Well, you don't have that. Well, how are you playing all these other places? Well, it's just on word of mouth. Like, how did you hear about us? Well, I heard about it from this other club owner. Like, okay, well, then book us. It'll be packed, I promise. And so slowly over time, we got a tiny bit of money together and made demos and started to do these things. But I mean, we were way into it before we ever had. In fact, let me say this. We did not have what anyone would consider to be a professional promo picture until we actually had a record deal. Everything we had was, we would go to the copy place and kind of make copies. It was so ghetto and hilarious. But anyway, I guess the lesson there was, a lot of bands were wasting their time doing silly things and when they should have been rehearsing, because we would annihilate bands because we had just hyper practiced, you know. Because you learn things. You learn things when you're constantly just running through the set. You learn stuff. You learn pacing. You learn, hey, maybe if we arrange this. And we would also play the same set for like a month, and then we would make an adjustment or maybe add a new song, and then we would play. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those kinds of things were good lessons that we learned. As far as bad ones, I guess the only thing would be when you start getting notoriety, other bands don't exactly love you that much. I guess bands that were your buddies one day suddenly think you're a bunch of jerks just because you're selling out places and they're not. And so we kind of learn that stuff too, you know. It kind of sucks.
It totally sucks. I used to hear that term selling out quite a lot at a point early on in my career as well, because I was in this hard rock band that was doing quite well. And when that band broke up, the next band I started was more of a, you know, kind of like a more melodic, dare I say, indie. I don't quite think we were indie, but it was definitely not hard rock. And I remember that particular band as well. We got pretty popular and we could sell out some venues. And the people that used to come watch the hard rock band would constantly use that term, selling out, you sold out, blah, 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 blah. And I remember this musician, this older guy that would sometimes come to some of the gigs, he actually said to me, there's no such thing as selling out unless you're selling out of your merchandise or your albums. And right. And it really like got me thinking quite differently about that whole term and how people use the term sellout when it comes to music, when, you know, realistically, most guys who are trying to get to a certain point are trying to make money. And isn't that the point? I'm not saying you got to sell your soul and totally do music you don't want to do and stuff, but isn't that the point? I mean, isn't that the reason why we're living in a time where a lot of people are doing these like 10-second clips all over the internet trying to be seen? You know, it's they're not doing it because they don't want to get notoriety. It's a very interesting concept, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that some of that came from, you know, University of North Texas is a big jazz music school. And so there's a certain element that, you know, it's very, very artistic and you should play really difficult music that maybe is only appreciated by other musicians. And I like that to an extent. I actually kind of come from that background. you know, as an undergraduate, I was the bass player in the 1 o'clock lab band, not at North Texas, but at Sam Houston. So I was around that type of perspective, and I liked it to an extent, you know, but you would sometimes go to these shows with, you know, the bands are, they got amazing chops, they're playing amazing things, but there's five guys in the audience and they're all in other bands, you know? So while I could appreciate that, I knew that when we started that, I wanted to write songs and do things that were more entertaining, you know? Now, but that didn't mean that we were going to, like you say, write songs or perform songs that we didn't like. But I knew that we wanted to write songs that were accessible because you're playing all original music. So for us, we focused on one thing, melody above everything else, which I garnered that from learning all these Pink Floyd songs.
Oh, cool.
You know, I was like, oh my gosh, if you have a moderate knowledge of guitar chords, you can play every Pink Floyd song ever written. I mean, maybe not the solos, but the basics of it, yeah. Right? Pink Floyd is amazing because of their melodies. We will write from that perspective. Simple chords that if you had to, if everything breaks down and you've got to sit there with an acoustic guitar, you can play your songs. That's how we'll do it. And so there was never any thought of like selling out. It was just, let's be practical about this. You know, otherwise, yeah, we will be playing in front of five other musicians and they may be very impressed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, where will we be in 5 years, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, it sounds like, you know, from my perspective, just listening to your story here, it sounds like you were sort of trying to serve the song, you know, and I'm a big fan of bands that serve the songs, you know, like, I mean, you know, you and I've spoken before, I'm a fan of yours and I think the songs are everything, man, because at the end of the day, you know, your band can be the hottest band since sliced bread, but if you don't have songs that people can sort of cotton onto or relate to or attach to, then again, you know, and again, I know there are these bands where, you know, a certain member of the band will have an iconic following because of their instrumentation, but I'm talking about the mass appeal, you know, the mass appeal comes down to songs, and that's still like that today. You've only got to turn on Top 40 radio to understand that.
Right. But I think if bands were a little bit more cognizant, like even if they wanted to be very, very artistic, for instance, if you were more cognizant of the songs, you would realize, if like take a band like Weather Report.
Yeah.
Okay, Jaco Pastorius was this fantastic bass player that everybody loves, but they wouldn't have known about him if it hadn't been for the songs he wrote, you know, as a solo artist. But I think more importantly with Weather Report, they had some amazing songs, even within kind of the confines of fusion jazz music, which can be very complicated.
Yeah.
But if you say, hey, hum that part to Teen Town, most people who are familiar with them can hum it. It's not just random insanity. They've written a complicated song and made it accessible. And I think that's where sometimes musicians or musos get a little too ahead of themselves. You know, we love Rush because they write great songs. They have complicated elements, but you can still sing along to them, you know.
Yeah, completely. So let's backtrack a little, because there's a few things I want to get into, but we should cover some ground first. So you guys prided yourself on being a live band, and you start getting popular, you start selling out venues, and eventually, I'm guessing, a deal comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through basically the process. You know, I mean, obviously it's going to be a long story. You don't have to go too in detail. But so you get this deal, you go record your album and stuff like that. When do things start to change for you? And what was the biggest adjustment from going from a, hey, we're a bunch of guys in this band that play our local town, to sort of receptive crowds to now, well, we're blowing up and now we're touring the world. What was the hardest part?
Well, see, okay, so for us, our story has some of those pieces out of order. Okay. We had actually recorded the home album as an indie band. Like we got a loan from a bank. The club owner that we played at, he co-signed it and made sure that we would just pay it back by playing shows if we had to. So we got this little loan, we got a loan for $5,000, and we spent a whopping $2,500 recording that album.
Wow.
But that was in place. Okay. And it found its way onto the radio here in Dallas and a couple of other towns and started selling. And it was only because of that we got the record deal. No one at a label said, oh, we're going to sign them and then you go make a record. No, they had all heard it. Our manager had taken it. And they had also, even the few that said, yeah, I kind of get it, but it's not going to work. It's the wrong time. It's not going to work. Well, it did work. And we started selling tons and then we got the record deal. I mean, they just came and stamped Interscope on it and there you go. I mean, we remixed a couple of songs but that was it. It was the same record.
Wow.
Right. So to answer your question though, what was the biggest adjustment? The biggest adjustment was every decision that we made about anything was us driving in a van to a show. Hey, should we do this? Okay. Hey, what do you think about this as a shirt design? Oh, that's pretty cool. You know, and just kind of talking through things. And suddenly when you're on a record label, well, now people are making decisions for you.
Yeah.
That was bizarre to us, especially later when it came time to go make another record. Because we're like, well, you didn't magically hear us back then. We're supposed to try to impress you with demos now. You know, you only understand this because we sell lots of records. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was the biggest adjustment. And I think that all these years later, us getting back together, part of the fun we have now is that we are kind of fully back to, well, we just decide what we want to do. If we want to play 50 shows this year, we play 50. If we want to play 5, we play 5.
That's cool.
You know, we release a song. You know, we'll just, hey, I got a song. Let's record it. Okay, cool. And you put it out. And then that's that. But that was a shocking thing. And that's really what kind of pushed me away from being a recording artist is that I couldn't stand my career and my life being in the hands of these other people. That I couldn't really tell their motivations or their perspectives or why they were even doing what they were doing. It was really strange, you know. And even going into a record label office and you think it's going to be like this ivory tower where these people are making these big decisions and there's secretaries and guys in three-piece suits sitting behind desks smoking cigars and making these, and it's not. And it's very, hey, man. You're like, holy hell, what have I done?
Yeah.
You know, that was the thing that was incredibly shocking for us.
Well, what's interesting with that is that module, even though we're talking years back, that's more how it works now. I mean, record labels come on board now basically when all the work is done. I mean, you build up a fan base, you have your album, you need your certain numbers on social media, and then suddenly they come a knocking. But, you know, back in the day, especially then, that's really unique. I mean, that didn't happen. You know, back then it was like, especially for you to have the masters of that album and then put that out. I mean, yeah, okay, they're going to remix certain things. That's just their way of getting their fingers in the pie. But let's talk about the masters. Did you guys get to keep those masters, or once you signed, did they suddenly have control of that?
Yeah, once you signed, then they have control of it. I think there's a window in the contract coming up at some point that we could get them back, you know, after a certain amount of time. But yeah, but once you sign, you they're buying them from you. Wow. Now, with that was an amazing $2,500 investment. I can tell you that much.
Of course.
You know, and I try to tell bands that, you know, like, especially when we were producing more, I try to tell them, never, ever, ever go into anything with the attitude of it's just a demo, because you don't know. Because, man, if you can make that work, if it has a certain sense of magic, and that doesn't mean that you need to obsess on it and to the point that you never release it because, oh, God, I just can't get the volume of the hi-hat right, and you talk yourself out of releasing it. You should try to just capture the intensity and the magic of what's going on, because it just might be the thing. And, man, it the profit margins there, not to get too money related, but the profit margins there are infinitely better.
Of course.
Than if you, because otherwise, you know, a lot of bands, oh, we got a $500,000 signing bonus. Well, yeah, then you went and spent $600,000 making an album. So you owe the label $100,000. You haven't made a penny.
Yeah.
You know, whereas with us, they bought the record from us.
Incredible.
You know, so that, so every, all of that went in into our pockets, and it made touring easy and all that kind of stuff. So I always try to tell bands that.
It's great advice, and it's such a cool position to be in. It's fascinating.
Yes.
It's truly fascinating. I could talk to you about this and nothing else for the rest of the interview, but but obviously I don't want to do that. So okay, let's talk a little bit about the changes you've seen, because obviously you've come full circle almost in regards to, you guys are back together and you're gigging and you're touring and all that kind of stuff now. But
yeah,
what are the sort of biggest changes you've seen since, I don't know, back then and now? Because what year did Breakfast at Tiffany's blow up?
It was really 96.
96. Okay. So, yeah. So,
yeah,
so 96. It's a while ago.
And then into 97, you know, as far as being in other parts, touring other parts of the world. So it was really 95, 96, 97. We were touring that record. Yeah. And, so yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, and on one of the interviews I listened to, and again I might have misquoted it slightly, but you were discussing something along the lines of when you guys first went to England, or when the label was considering putting it out over there, they were trying to convince you guys that, you know, it's not a single. And that kind of stuff blows my mind, because I've heard similar stories with some other people I know that had monster hits with some sort of single that they believed in that the label tried to talk them out of. And it kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier about not having this control. And it's just, it's quite an interesting topic to talk about, because I think everybody now, and again, I'm stereotyping here, but I think a lot of people now seem to think that if you don't have the help of all these people, you don't have a team of a PR person, a booking agent, a manager, a label guy, an A&R guy, a personal manager, a business manager, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that you don't have a chance. But again, if you look at how things are working now with people going viral on TikTok and viral on Instagram or YouTube, it's like,
yeah,
you don't actually, and again, it might not happen, but a lot of these people don't have any of these kinds of parts in place. So
yeah.
So it's really quite fascinating. What was the story there? They just didn't want to put it out as a single, or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, it wasn't that they didn't want to put it out as a single. They just weren't going to put it out. Like, they weren't going to release Breakfast at Tiffany's, like, at all.
Wow.
Because, you know, you're signed to a parent label, and then that parent label has distribution, separate distribution in each country. So the UK, it was MCA Universal. You know, we were signed to Interscope, and Interscope had distribution through MCA Universal. Okay, great. So we go to have a meeting. And again, this is after being on tour for over a year throughout the world to talk about plans for finally releasing in the UK, which of course is very important to us because that's where all our favorite bands come from.
Yeah.
And they just said, we don't think it's going to work. And we were kind of, okay, well, yeah, nobody can make any promises. And they said, no, we're not going to release it. Congratulations. That was the phrase. I'll never forget it. Congratulations on your success in the rest of the world, but we don't think it's going to work here.
Wow.
And we're just all sitting there going, and literally, though, in my mind that day, that's when I was, I can't handle this. This is where the whole thing breaks down. It's been lovely. We sold a lot of records. I've seen the world. I've done everything I want to do. But this is the idiocy of the music business.
Yeah.
Now, what made it even crazier, though, is that the record store chains kept calling the label saying, when is this record coming out? We are shipping insane amounts of German imports here. The kids are paying double the price of what they would normally pay. What's going on with this record? And then the German label was calling the English label and saying, hey, we kind of need these here. Why don't you print your own, jackasses, so that we can sell the German ones in Germany? And, you know, what's going on? And so they were forced to release it. They never wanted to. They were never convinced. They had to. And even then, they were still reluctant and didn't print up enough. So instead of, we didn't debut at number one, we debuted at three because they sold out of product.
Wow.
And then the same thing the next week, we went up to two. And then finally, they opened the floodgates and we hit number one. And we're going, you idiots, you know. And I'm not exaggerating. When we had gone back to Top of the Pops, when we did go number one, and I was just sitting there in the dressing room going, I think I'm going to quit. Like, I think this is it. I'm done. Because it was the last country. Like, we were on tour in Sweden, and we'd flown over to do Top of the Pops because we were supposed to have flown home. Like, it was the last date of this world tour. We had been gone for 2.5 years. We were supposed to fly home, and they said, hey, you went number one. We need you to fly back over here to do Top of the Pops. And we were like, son of a gun. Okay, here we go. You know, instead of being ecstatic because we were so over it because of these people.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't care about music. They don't have a crystal ball. And they never admit that they don't. They think they do. And so I was just like, I think I should just quit. I'm kind of, this is ridiculous. I'm, you know. And I tell people too, I had this vision when I was 17, I went to the Hard Rock Cafe in London, and the record company offices of MCA are right next door, right next door. I had never seen a record company before, but I stood there as a 17-year-old and said, one day I'm going to walk through that door. Well, that was the label that we were a part of, MCA. And so when we went back to promote our second single, I actually got to go in that door. And I saw what looked like a college student's dorm room. And I thought, yeah, okay, great, great. You know, the dream many times is so much better than the reality. Even though, I don't want to sound jaded or bitter, because I've had a fantastic time and I am beyond thankful for everything. But there are those moments where you're like, you have got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
You know, so funny.
Well, man, it's such interesting stuff because, well, firstly, I'm a big believer in, like, you know, positive thinking and manifestation and stuff like that. And it sounds to me like you put that out there and achieved that, which is incredible, firstly. Secondly, you know, talking to you, you seem very well educated about the music business. And, you know, I've had a couple similar stories not quite to the extreme of what you're talking about, but I've had some incidences with label heads that have made me also question, you know, how much control I want them to have. And I always sort of walk this fine line between, no, I'm going to stay independent and I'll do things how I want to do it versus getting these people involved. But man, it's, how did you stay positive and motivate yourself to keep going when you're in this mindset where you've kind of, let's for a lack of a better phrase, you've almost accepted that a lot of people around you managing the business are doing very moronic things?
Yeah.
What did you do mindset wise to stay in a positive place here?
You've got to figure out how to separate, I think, the record side of it from the band playing live side of it, you know, because if we, you know, to this day, when we're on stage, everything is fantastic. It is transcendent. It is magical. It is hilarious. When we're on stage, it's awesome. Okay. So that keeps you going. That makes it worth all the headaches of this and that. So that side of the band was really okay most of the time. So dealing with record companies, well, that's a different thing. You know what I'm saying? Like you have to kind of look at it as, you know, going to get a loan for a mortgage on a house. You know they're taking advantage of you, but you go into it and you just try to set your percentages, but you know they're kind of screwing you in a way. It would be handier if you didn't have to, but that's kind of how it works. They make money off of you that way. But you just got to kind of read through things and see where they're screwing you and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But as far as staying positive, I don't know. I mean, I think there's, you know, I got to admit, there was kind of a special magical feeling after being told it wasn't going to work and then going number one. You know, that I always tell people, spite is a magical feeling, you know, and that happening and them showing up backstage at Top of the Pops with a fruit basket trying to apologize. Yeah, that was a good feeling, you know. So that kind of thing motivates you too, that you know that in the grand scheme of things, you did win, but you got kicked pretty hard in the junk beforehand. So I guess maybe you appreciate it better, I suppose, but you've just got to learn to roll with the absurdity of all of it, because it is nuts. Like when I think about all these things that happened, because the England record company scenario was a very pinpointed version of 10,000 other things that had happened. You know, every town we went to, I don't know if the song fits the format. I don't know if it's the right time. Very few places said, oh, hell yeah, we're going to play the hell out of the song. Hmm. You know, it was state by state, country by country. You know, the England one was just the most pointed when they just said no.
Yeah.
Everybody else had kind of said no. So that keeps you moving, you know. And then, you know, all these years later, it to be continuing, you still think, oh, okay, it all worked out in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
We can appreciate that.
It's absolutely incredible. It's kind of blown my mind over here. I'm not going to lie. It's just like, I've never understood it. You know, why sign an artist if you're going to just sit on their stuff or try and get them to change their sound? It makes no sense. It makes no sense.
And that's true. But see, that's where the problem is. Because again, Interscope had signed us. MCA, they were just the distributor, you know, in the UK. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So they don't really have any tie to it. To them, it's like, well, why should we like this? We didn't sign this band. You're just part of this. But still the attitude should be, well, let's try to sell records. I mean, Frank Zappa, I think years ago, because he was a genius guy,
yeah.
said that the record business was actually better when it was guys in suits that told you up front they don't know anything about the music business. They were there to because of sales, right? It was, and they would just say, well, the band seems to have a following. Let's make a record, see if we can sell it. I don't know. I don't get it. But they didn't try. They didn't pretend to. It was when over time record companies started hiring hip young people that knew, quote unquote.
Yeah.
That's when the record companies started getting crazy. And that's where you get these people that think they can predict the future, you know?
Yeah.
But you live and learn.
Man. Okay. So with how much the industry has changed, even though a lot of it is still the same, what advice would you offer up-and-coming bands on? I mean, obviously you mentioned the don't focus on trying to make just a demo, try and make it as good as you can. But what advice would you offer them on, you know, trying to take care of business and just do their thing in a, dare I say, a post-label kind of world?
Yeah. I think I would say the band or the artist needs to focus on the music. Okay. Find someone else, even if it's a friend or somebody that you pay or whatever, to do all of the other stuff, because you have to. I mean, it is sort of a wonderful time, but it's also a crazy time that, you know, if you You can go just hit a piano with a hammer for 5 minutes, and you can do that today, and you can have it on Spotify on next Tuesday, right? Anyone can release anything worldwide all the time. So that creates an immense amount of static out there. So you do need to have an online presence, and it needs to be focused, and it needs to be well done, and that kind of thing. You have to have these things. But I find that artists, young artists especially, end up focusing all their time on their online presence to the detriment of their music, right? So I would just say, find a friend, say you're our Instagram person or whatever. So all social media, you take pictures of us. Here's some logos, but you take care of this, and we'll count you as a fifth band member if you want. I think it's that important.
Yeah.
So that the band can focus writing songs, recording them, and playing shows. Because I don't think young bands in Dallas-Fort Worth, at least I've noticed, are not playing shows. They're all trying to make it online first and then play shows. When it would probably be better suited, you know, start playing shows and then maybe make a record.
Yeah.
You know, right now they're trying to come up with a logo, have an online presence, make, you know, record this magical bedroom demo, and then maybe I'll play some shows when I have a million followers. It should still probably be the other way, because then you can figure out, oh, the audience seems to like it when we do this. Maybe we could enhance this a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, find somebody that can help you publicize, because I've seen people just get so totally caught up in that aspect that the music is nothing.
Yeah, I saw a post on, ironically, Instagram a few weeks back, and I think I actually might have spoken about it with one of my previous guests, but it basically said, like, we're in a time in music where focusing on algorithms seems more important than focusing on art. And it really hit home, because it's basically what you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, and you can, you know... The one good thing is you can be a very, very niche person if you want. If you want to do, you know, country and Western electronic black metal, I guarantee you there's an audience for that. And you can navigate your way to that specific audience, right? And that's an amazing thing. So you can really probably more than ever really follow your artistic instincts while you're kind of cultivating an audience. But just don't lose the plot, you know. Don't chase the algorithm, make your music, you know, and because of that, you can really find some amazing genres out there.
Yeah, that's
cool. I got really into Witch House a while back. Have you ever heard of that genre?
No.
It's kind of great. It's sort of 80s goth. I don't know. Look it up, Witch House. It's interesting.
Dude, I'll look it up the moment we finished. It sounds interesting. And I love 80s, and I kind of love goth, so it's bound to be great.
It's definitely, but it's a whole subculture, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah, there's stuff out there.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt, man. I'll totally check it out. So you and your brother have been working together pretty much forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to touch base a little bit about the recording side. I mean, I know you guys have a studio. I know you're more into the mastering side now. But, you know, what led to you guys getting into that side of it and becoming producers and working with bands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, I don't know how we ended up jumping into that. I know, you know, the first thing we did with any money that we got was buy recording gear. And then the studio that we eventually opened sort of grew out of our rehearsal place,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the band was sort of paying to, you know, we would pay to rehearse there. And then after a while I said, hey, I think I can charge enough so the band doesn't need to pay rent, you know, because we're doing some sessions and oh, that's cool. And then very slowly, of course, the producing takes over and the band kind of fades away. But that was sort of during the time that people were starting to have kids and stuff anyway. So it happened really organically, but just from us trying to, you know, trying to fulfill the role that we wanted. You know, we worked with some pretty cool people when we were first starting, and it was a great help. And we just thought, well, maybe we can help people. And again, with that attitude of, you know, again, don't make a demo. You need to make the best record that you can afford to make.
Yeah.
You know, allow space for magic to occur. And then so the role of the producer is to try to encourage that. You know, so if a band comes in and says, you know, I've got $400 and I'd really like to try to record two songs, and we're okay, let's figure out how to do this. You know, usually that would mean us giving them several days for free because we would get obsessive and try to make it amazing. But you try to figure these things out and to help the band. And along the way, we recorded some really pretty great stuff.
Oh, you know, you've got a great credit list. I was reading about it earlier today.
You know, and you get to, you know, I love the technical side of things. So especially if it's a really low budget or, you know, high pressure, short window thing, you know, I'm always thinking, how can I make this the greatest sounding thing ever, even though we've only got 3 hours to do all the tracking?
Wow.
You know, I love that. I think it's super fun.
So if you had to choose performer or producer, what would you ideally go with?
Producer.
Is that because prefer studio environments or I don't know, why?
I think so. I mean, again, don't get me wrong, because I do mean it when I say when we play live, it's every show is magical for us. But at the same time, if something happened and I never performed again, I think I could live without that. But if I go too long without being in a studio recording something, I kind of freak out a little bit. Hmm. So I know that that's sort of where my heart is. Even though being on stage is very natural, and again, being with the guys is wonderful, and I love to play the bass. I couldn't care less about singing. I don't value that at all.
Interesting.
But I do love playing the bass. But still, yeah, I think if I had to choose, I'd choose producing or engineering. I probably do. I love mastering. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So weird and technical.
And you're great at it. So, you know, you've obviously spent a good bit of time figuring all those niches out, you know.
Yeah.
So, but interesting. But I was in a band or several bands with my brother for years. We played together. Probably, man, I don't want to be misquoted, but I think we were probably in bands together on and off for 15, 16 years. And I do know that there are times when working in a musical situation, for me at least, that it was maybe harder having family do it in a everybody get on the same page point of view than maybe just a stranger that becomes like a non-blood brother. But there are, of course, perks to it as well. You know, you get to experience things with your brother that I think a lot of siblings maybe would never get to experience together.
Right.
But what, if any, were some of the interesting moments of working with a sibling in a band for you?
I don't know. It's never been super weird. And maybe it's because, you know, I play bass and he plays lead guitar. So no matter what, we're not stepping on each other's toes, even though I do get a little busy sometimes, but whatever. You know, whereas if we were both wanting to be guitar players, that could be conflict. Okay. As far as singing, I don't think either one of us really wants to be the lead singer guy. It's usually the rule in the band is usually if you write the words, you have to sing it. Okay. So again, that's an obligation thing. It's not that, oh, I got to be the singer. So that competition doesn't quite exist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Within the band, we kind of have specific roles. You know, I usually believe it or not, I kind of leave a lot of the decision making to Toby and John.
Cool.
Because they'll have like a stronger opinion. Now, I'll put in my two cents, but I can be convinced of lots of things. You know, if somebody said, we've got a show for you in Antarctica, initially I'd be like, I don't know if I want to do that, but I think I could be talked into that pretty easily. Whereas Toby and John might have some sort of principled stance of why we shouldn't do this. Okay. So, but I am the guy very much so that, okay, well, we've decided that we're doing this. And so in order to accomplish this, we're going to rehearse this many times, you know, so I'm a little bit more of the drill sergeant.
Yeah.
And, you know, once they've kind of made the decision, if that makes sense, because again, I can be talked into lots of things. They put their foot down a lot more.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that keeps the conflict down. It's also easier now than it used to be, because for years and years, we were a four piece. When we reformed, Kirk came back because Clay had taken Kirk's place.
Okay.
On rhythm guitar. But when we sort of started redoing things, we wanted to do a couple of songs that Toby and Kirk had written. We're like, hey, let's ask Kirk if he wants to play with us again. And then we thought, well, just because we're bringing Kirk back doesn't mean that we need to push Clay out of the way. Let's try this as a five piece. And oh my gosh, I wish we had done this all along.
Cool.
Because now there's an uneven number. So any sort of, you know, very casual vote of, hey, do we want to do this? Or do we like this t-shirt design? It's very quick. Whereas with you four people, sometimes you're at a stalemate instantly.
Yeah. You need a tiebreaker. <You know? laughs>
Yeah. And you need, and that's what I tell people all the time. The only thing that was really ever frustrating about having a brother in the band is that sometimes Toby and I would disagree on something fairly small. Okay. But instead of the other guys just instantly chipping in and saying, oh, I think we should go with that and fixing it, they would just sit there and watch us argue. So very small things would turn into big arguments where we would inevitably end up yelling at them for not chiming in and helping us settle this. You know, whereas the five piece, somebody is always going to speak up and go, yeah, I think that's probably a better idea.
Yeah.
And then we go with it. So that, yeah, that was really the only thing. That man, there were some hilarious tiny arguments that could have been settled in 10 seconds that went on for hours. Good times.
I can totally relate, man, because I feel like that's what it was like with my brother. It's like we didn't typically argue about the music necessarily, but it's exactly like you said, would be something so ridiculous. And because you're family, you can kind of take more liberties, even though you probably shouldn't. You just do because you're more comfortable with each other. And therefore you seem to talk to each other in a fashion that sometimes you go, wait, if this guy wasn't my brother, would we have just spoken to each other like that? Probably not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You're a little short. You're a little blunt. Yeah. Like if I was telling somebody this the other day, like, you know, if I feel like Kirk is, because Kirk stands right by me on stage, if I feel like Kirk's a little loud, I'll very casually go, hey man, can we maybe, you know, bring it down just a little bit? And he's always like very, oh yeah, of course, sorry. But if Toby's really loud, I'll go up to the microphone. Dear God, could you be any louder? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, man.
And of course, vice versa too. You know, somebody, Toby will say something like, oh, I don't know if anybody here can hear anything other than the bass, you know, so it's
awesome.
Just that kind of bluntness, you know, yeah, good times.
So here's a bit of an interesting question, and I don't have many more for you, but I did want to talk about this one. So songwriting splits, when you're in a band, it's interesting because there seems to be kind of two schools of thought. School of thought one is, well, we kind of jammed this idea until it became a song and we should split that song equally. School of thought two is, well, I came in with this idea pretty much finished and you guys added your little nuances to it, but now you want equal rights. What are your thoughts on this?
My thing is, obviously, if it's, you know, somebody has a small idea and we jam on it and it turns into a song, everybody gets credit. Okay. Or if you happen to be hanging out in the room while I'm writing the song, I'll give you credit because I feel like you've somehow probably inspired something. But if I've written it by myself, it's my song And that's it, you know, there was a little friction about that kind of in the beginning, but I think as everybody sort of became songwriters, it's like, okay, I get that, you know. And some people say that bands that split everything equally, you know, as far as publishing, that's why bands break up, is because, well, even if a band splits everything equally, there's usually one guy that's writing a lot of the stuff and one guy, at least one guy, who's writing very, very little. And that's what makes people say, screw this.
Yeah.
You know? So it has worked for us, you know, but there is at least in the beginning, there was some, hey, what the hell, you know?
Is that because a song like Breakfast at Tiffany's is pretty much credited to you? Was the animosity because that's the hit and you're the writer?
It's just when nobody had really thought about that until all of a sudden, you know, that was getting offered a big publishing deal. And it was kind of like, oh, you know. And, you know, my argument at the time was, well, you know, all you guys are kind of going out and having fun, and I'm in my apartment writing songs. That's what, because I would always try to, every time we rehearsed, I tried to have a new song. So I'm like, again, if you're just hanging out, I'll give you credit. But if I'm writing it by myself, I'm writing it by myself. So again, it's worked for us. It doesn't work for other bands, but I love it the best when we create something as a band. Some of my favorite songs are the ones that somebody had maybe a tiny idea and it turned into a song. I love those.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've always been a fan of that as well. I think there's something special that happens when everybody gives input, but I've also been on the flip side of that where, you know, you come in with a fully formed song. You've done the demo, the arrangement stays the same, the lyrics stay the same, everything stays the same. But hypothetically, a guitarist will put a guitar line on top of it. That's maybe just, you know, his own version of something you did or her own version of something you did. And, you know, I've been in a position whereby suddenly that person wants equal stake to a song and you go, but dude, like, all you did was play guitar on it. I could have played guitar on it. And it's an interesting thing, because it's like, you know, it's like you say, it definitely causes some issues, because what I've experienced and read about as well in my life is, you know, these bands that split it evenly sometimes will seem to stay together longer than the bands that don't. But like you say, there's sometimes it goes the complete opposite way, because animosity almost kicks in, because person A, who did write all the songs or put most of the work in, goes, well, why do I have to split this with everybody when they're not actually doing any work towards it? It's a very, very fine line, you know?
Yeah. I remember Steven Tyler, they had some kind of arrangement early, which did change. But early on, they had this arrangement that the writer would get, I think, 50% or something, and then split the other 50% among the band members, you know? And he was like, So he writes Dream On.
Yeah.
Well, they had kind of signed this fairly rough deal with their manager. And so he ended up making like less than the band members on a song that he wrote 100% himself.
Wow.
And he was like, he always hated that. And so as time went on, he just finally said, look, we're not doing this, you know. But then you have a band like Van Halen. They always split everything, but a band like Van Halen, even though, you know, Eddie wrote the riffs, they always kind of came across as everyone contributing. So I don't know how that worked. I know Duran Duran truly did write together 99% of the time.
That's cool.
So yeah, it is. Yeah. They would just go in there and start doing stuff. And that's fantastic.
I agree. All right, Todd, I have one last question for you, and it's a little bit loaded. I ask everybody, so don't feel like you have to rush, take your time. But what do you think has been the best piece of advice you've ever received in regards to your career?
Whew. Dang.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit of a crap question, but
it's a great question. I just don't know that I've been given very much good advice.
Well, hey, we can flip it on its head. What's some of the worst advice you've ever had?
No. Okay. Well, let me say this though, not related to my career specifically, but related to singing. Okay. And I do this actually surprisingly comes up a lot because people ask, well, now that you're really old, can you still sing? And here's why. Because my dad did say, because my parents were are fantastic singers, okay, and they would always impart little bits of wisdom. My mom was sometimes a little bit more melody and technique, and hey, pay attention to this. Do you hear that? That's really cool. But my dad one time said, figure out your vocal range and sing within your vocal range, and you will be able to sing all day, every day. 365 days a year, you'll be able to sing when you're sick, you'll be able to sing when you're not, and it will always be perfect. But if you try to push beyond your range, you will ruin your voice and you won't be able to do it. And I was like, oh, okay. And so my whole life, I have always written songs that are very comfortable for me to sing. And all these years later, I can still hit all the notes. So that was good advice.
Yeah, it's excellent advice. It's so simple but almost overlooked.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
But I think that comes from not being a lead singer, because lead singers always want to show off and be lead singers and do all that kind of stuff. Whereas I'm just trying to be the bass player. That's all I care about. So I have to sing. So it's easier for me to think, I'm gonna write the coolest bass line ever, and yeah, I'll sing these words, whatever. So I sing very comfortably, and I'm just killing myself on the bass.
Oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, Todd, dude, thank you so, so very much for your time and your willingness to impart wisdom. I appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on. This was really fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Excellent.
Bye. Sweet. Todd Pipes, everybody. I'll leave show notes as usual. You can go check out Deep Blue Something. You can go check out Todd and his studios. I know I said it in the beginning of the episode, and I know I say it in every episode, but please, guys, if you don't mind, give us a rating or a review. It really helps us across all streaming platforms. And I just want to say a massive thank you if you're still listening. I appreciate you, appreciate those around you, and keep pushing, man. This music malarkey is a wonderful thing. Until next time, peace.